So let's try to sort out the way the three approved drugs can be integrated into practice. Why don't we start out with the most recent one? In a way, it's sort of the simplest, at least because there's one major study. I think at least that, from my point of view, at least makes it a little bit easier to deal with. So let's start out with niraparib. Can you talk about the clinical research that's been done on the drug, the approval, and how you see it being used?
Okay. So niraparib, like the other two PARP inhibitors, was shown to have good single-agent activity in, you know, small phase 1, phase 2 studies in BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer. Study 19 was the first maintenance study with olaparib that showed activity not only in the BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, but globally in all patients, including those that did not have a BRCA mutation. So on the basis of that, they designed a trial modeling it on study 19, namely that they would take patients with platinum-sensitive disease responding to platinum and then offer maintenance niraparib. And what they did was to divide their patients into two cohorts. So effectively, it was almost like two separate randomized trials. Group one was a group of patients with germline BRCA mutation, because that's where they knew the strongest data were from the previous data with olaparib. And then the second cohort was non-germline BRCA mutation. So really a pool of different groups of patients that we can come back to in a moment. And those patients were randomized 2-to-1 to niraparib or placebo post-platinum-based chemotherapy. Now, what that trial showed was that if you look at the global endpoints of those two cohorts, that in both cohorts, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival using maintenance niraparib over placebo in both the germline BRCA mutant cohort and the non-germline BRCA mutant cohort. And that actually was the basis of their submission to the FDA on the basis that they had two cohorts, germline, non-germline BRCA mutation, and both those individual cohorts showed significant clinical benefit from niraparib. And it was actually on the basis of that that the FDA gave a global approval for niraparib as maintenance therapy in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. Now, if you drill down a little bit more into the non-germline BRCA mutant group, there are three subclasses, if you like, within that. There are those who have a somatic BRCA mutation. About 5% or so of all those patients will have a somatic mutation. And interestingly, the activity of niraparib in that group was virtually identical in terms of the PFS and the hazard ratio to the germline group, which just supports what we've said earlier, that these drugs are active in both germline and somatic BRCA mutations. But what they then did was to look at the Myriad assay, which gives a measure of HR deficiency, and divided this subgroup of non-germline patients into HRD positive and HRD negative groups. And what you saw was, using that assay, that niraparib was still significantly active in both the HRD positive and HRD negative group. The degree of activity as measured by the hazard ratio was diminishing, but there was still statistical significance in terms of PFS.
Another question, I'm guessing that these patients did not receive the drug on relapse. Is that true?
There was no crossover.
No crossover in the control group.
There was no crossover to control group.
And yes. I mean, the hazard rates are very impressive for progression-free survival. You know, in the germline group, it's 0.27. In the HRD, it's 0.38. And then the other one, it's 0.45, no germline. But what about survival? Is it too early? And what would you expect with these kinds of hazard rates? And also, what about the issue of crossover?
Okay. So I think, first of all, it is too early to know what the long-term benefits of niraparib are. And I think it's really important that we wait and we see those.